Lots of martial artists like weapons. I have never met anyone who is as comprehensively obsessed with swords as Six Wetzler, who is has a PhD in it's like old Norse, Scandinavian, Norse literature and martial arts, and is now, I think his plan is to own and become synonymous with and to embody the German Blade Museum in Solingen. So, Dr. Six Wetzler, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you, Paul, for inviting me. How are you?
I'm good, yeah. I'm wearing the t-shirt you gave me,
Yes,
the
super nice.
training
Super nice.
diagram t-shirt.
Yes, the geometry of the fighting, very good.
Yeah, that's a hell of a diagram, isn't it?
Nice. Yeah, it is. It is.
So, yeah, it's good to see you. So, we've met maybe a dozen times, maybe a little bit less. We've
Yeah.
worked together on different projects. You've been to almost all of the martial arts studies conferences, and you've published in the Martial Arts Studies Journal, and you are an all-round martial arts enthusiast on every single level. Is that right?
That's true. That's the definition, I'd say. Yeah.
So shall we start with swords? I
Yeah.
mean, I've never I a lot of
I
people like
also
yeah.
have my swordy t-shirt, especially for today.
That's the
So.
next t-shirt I want. So you kind of quit academia. You didn't quit academia. I mean, you can't be a museum curator and not be an academic, but you went through academia, you got your PhD, and you took a temporary job in the Blade Museum, in the Knife Museum, and you realized that this was your perfect environment. Is that right?
Yeah, that's more or less it. I was still working on my PhD when a friend approached me, an archaeologist from Freiburg, where I come from, Lisa Deutscher, and she had the brilliant idea to host a conference on swords, which we did then in 2012 together with two other archaeologists from Freiburg, Miriam Kaiser and Marius Michel. And we started a conference there. So that was in 2012, and that kind of set the path. I've been a knife and blade enthusiast for a long time, and I'm a good friend of Peter Jonsson, who is one of the most renowned swordsmiths for modern swords. So via this conference and my connection to Peter Jonsson, I some way ended up here at Deutsches Klingenmuseum in 2013 to start and prepare a huge exhibition on medieval European swords, which was hosted in 2015. And then at the beginning, I was working here as a freelancer, and then I got just very, very lucky, or maybe it was fate. So in 2016, the current job where I'm on now, the deputy or assistant director of the museum, became free, and I applied and I got the job, and now I'm here.
And this is better for you than a university job because you're surrounded by swords.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. No, really, it is, for the one hand, it is about the object. Yeah. I like being in touch with the physicality of things. And then on the other hand, I've been in academia for a long time. I started, or I taught classes at the university, as well, beginners classes. But I like being at a museum because there are so many levels. Yeah. Now I'm having a Zoom meeting with a distinguished professor in the UK. And when Corona is over, I'll start to teach sword fighting classes for school kids again. I organize an exhibition. So there are so many different levels. And I think academia, like proper academia, can hardly provide all these various aspects. Yeah. I like the flexibility of the job that I'm doing.
Yeah, and but you still closely connect with research, and you still publish
Yes.
articles and collections and all kinds of things, yeah?
It is according to the definition, international definition of the museum, one of the five main goals, jobs of a museum is to do research. So this is obviously part of my job, and also even part of my job description, that I'm supposed to do research on the objects that we have and their historical context.
Okay. I'm just sharing a screen there of some pictures of Six Wetzler, and here we have on the right there's your Pekiti Tersia Kali seminars, and then there's you holding various weapons and smiling, looking cheeky there. So tell me your relationship with Pakiti Tersi. I mean, which came first, your interest in swords or your interest in, I mean, how did you find Pakiti Tersi of all things? It doesn't, it's not a mainstream thing, certainly not in the UK.
Yeah, it's not a mainstream thing. I started training in martial arts 30 years ago. I was fascinated with martial arts since I was like 9 years old, at least, when I watched the 36th Chamber of the Shaolin for the first time. That was my like epiphany moment in my life. And also I was fascinated with swords and knives and blades for as long as I can remember. So I studied various martial arts. I started in Shotokan Karate. And then when I moved to Tübingen to study, I checked what kind of martial arts are there, what could I train. And I had a little bit exposition to Filipino martial arts before. And I always was super interested because I was interested, of course, in the blade work, but also the stick and like the open self-defense approach of the Filipino martial arts. And then I heard that there's the Pakiti Tersi group in Reutlingen, which is only like 10 kilometers from Tübingen. And Uli Weidler was the head teacher for the system for Europe, was teaching there. And I said, well, let's give it a try. At the same time, I was still doing full contact karate, Enshin karate and Muay Thai. So for a couple of years, I trained both. And then I decided to go, to quit my sports career and go head on into the Pakiti Tersi and concentrate.
And was that because you were more interested in the breadth of the syllabus and the range of the kind of approaches, or just because you weren't that motivated by competition, or?
Both. Pakiti Tersi, when I saw it first, was like the answer for me, the thing that I had always been looking for in martial arts since I was that nine-year-old boy watching the Shaolin monks. So this was what I wanted. And on the other hand, I love the Enshin karate and I love the sporty fighting, and I took part in various tournaments and full contact fights. But this is something that you can do only so long. And it started to wear down on my body. So I had, like, after one tournament, I was for 2 weeks, every morning I woke up, my legs were numb from the low kicks that I got in the tournament. And I thought, maybe that's not the perspective for the rest of my life to do that. And so both these reasons, the fascination for the Filipino martial arts and the understanding that I will not be a professional sports MMA or Muay Thai fighter, led me to the decision to go into Pakiti Tersi.
And you, was the conference at Solingen, the Deutsches Klingen Museum, was that the start of your interest in the relationship between martial arts and academic work? And then there was a conference, was it organized by Peter Kuhn? That was the first of the German martial arts studies kind of conferences. When was that one, the first?
It was in 2011.
Okay.
2011. Peter Kuhn organized the first German conference on Kampfsport und Kampfkunst in wissenschaftlicher Perspektive, martial arts studies. In English, at the University of Bayreuth. And this was, for us in Germany, this was the starting point. So a huge part of the crowd that is still there and working on the topics were there back then already.
Yeah. So they were all like, lots of these people who are now professors, they were students then, yeah.
Yeah, we've come a long way.
I remember the first conference that I held in Cardiff. And it was almost like the people came from all over the place, from all over the world, and a huge coach load of people came from Germany.
It's like, we have to go there. Of course. Yeah. In 2000, your first conference was in 2015, wasn't
15,
it?
I think, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And by then we already had the organizational structure. By then we had become an official committee within the German Society for Sports Studies. So there was also the infrastructure, and we communicated before and hey, let's go there. It looks super interesting.
Yeah. It was good. And it was great to get kind of hooked up with the German network, because it's so very, it's very established, very organized, very connected, funded as well, which is how the hell does that happen? But in Germany, they don't do things unless they're funded, right? You just, you do a conference if it's funded.
Yes, depending on which level in academia you are. So sometimes you just do it for the fun of it. You don't have money, but usually you would say, okay, we need some backup for that.
And are you still on that committee, on the DVS committee, or?
Yeah, I'm still working with them. But honestly, I have to admit, at the moment, I have so many things going on at the museum that I have to concentrate more on what's going on here. So I do not give as much input at the moment as I would wish or as would be good. But I hope that will change also in the next years.
Mm-hmm. And you are also the author of a very widely cited, very widely referred to article that was in, I think, issue 2 of Martial Arts Studies. And it was called, it might have been called Martial Arts Studies as Culture of Wissenschaft.
Yes.
And it's been hugely influential, I think, not influential enough to my mind, in which, could you tell us a little bit about your argument in that article?
The article arose from the age-old definition question that you also have been talking and have been writing about a lot. And when I approach martial arts studies, I bring in the background, my academic background, how I was trained in Tübingen. I did my PhD in Scandinavian studies, but my main subject while I was studying and also my master thesis was in history of religion in Tübingen, which has a special approach. The Tübingen school was very strong, and especially my professor, Burkhard Gladigo, who is just a genius, and he influenced me tremendously in my way of thinking in general, and also my academic thinking. And I was wondering how could I apply the methods and the way of thinking that I learned from Professor Gladigo, how could I apply that to martial arts studies? He had a very clear and crisp way to understand systems and put perspectives. How can we describe systems? Not definition in that way, trying to get an angle on a phenomenon that otherwise is too fluid to be described. And I try to transfer these methods from the history of religion of the Tübingen school to martial arts studies.
You come up with a kind of, it's almost like a Venn diagram approach, isn't it? If the universal set is martial arts, you have an image of, there's different overlapping and interlocking meanings, values, social functions, psychological functions, some of which are spirit. And you suggest there's probably about 5 main ones.
Yeah, I thought there are 5 main ones. Now, my own thinking and the discussions with many people have brought me, there might be others as well. And then I wonder whether they are like super or under categories that I should put next to my 5 categories, or I should above them or below them. So the categories that I described were preparation for violence, sports, combat, performative action, transcendent goals, and healthcare. And I said already when I described that this is not a definite list, there are only these 5, but these were the most dominant that came to my mind. And now our friend Ben Judkins, for example, already 2 years ago, has pointed out, what about economy? There is clearly, and there has been for hundreds of years, an economic dimension to martial arts. Martial arts are something that is sold. But this, then I wonder, might be under category or super category, because any of these 5 other categories can be something that you sell. You sell martial arts as self-defense, preparation for violence. You sell it as healthcare. So these, then the economic category, for example, interconnects. The same for the creation of social unity, of creating groups. This is obviously super important. Again, something that Ben Judkins probably made me aware of the strongest in his book together with Nielsen on the history of Wing Chun. How important this community building is in martial arts. And again, this can be superimposed on all these other categories, I think.
Yeah, I guess, I wonder if, I think my because I really liked it, and I liked the clarity that you offered to like, we don't define it. We've got a term that we currently use, and like when we look at it now, we can see all of these different shifting functions, and we can look at it through a historical lens and go, different martial arts have changed their status over time, and what may once have been approach for self-defense or preparation for violence now becomes more spiritual or for health matters or whatever. But I guess my question was about, it seemed a little bit too formalistic. It still seemed a little bit too like a snapshot, like we can look now and apply the lenses and concerns of our times now back and map out, you know, changing status. But really there's a bit too much, I thought perhaps still a little bit too much kind of projection in the sense of projecting a neatness onto the world. That was my argument. My response to you was always, it's more messy than that. It what you're saying is helpful, but it's still got to, it still feels more complicated than that.
It is absolutely more complicated. I mean, this is not a model that I propose. It's a tool set. It is just various lenses through which you could look at martial arts. And sometimes some of these five dimensions, I think, are forgotten when we talk about any given martial arts. And this is just, I just wanted to remind that there's always more to it than what it seems. Even if you look at, for example, Shotokan Karate, which is one of the most widespread styles over the world, I guess, at least definitely in Germany. So what is this? If you look at a homepage, then usually they would tell you it's about fitness, it's about self-defense, it's about self-development. What is it for the individual? Is it also about healthcare, for example? Oh yes, now that you ask, I'm actually doing it to become fit. So these categories should be just tools, reminders, what you can ask of a martial art. They are no description of that is. It's just questions that you should raise, I think, when you talk about martial arts, and especially I think in the historical dimension, for example, if we talk about economy, one of these other categories that I at some point have to include into my system, if you ask modern martial artists, or if you look at internet boards, there's often this notion, in the olden days it was all about like true fighting, but nowadays people sell off their martial arts. But then you look at the history of, for example, Chinese martial arts or European martial arts. In the Middle Ages, people were selling these martial arts naturally because it was a skill that they had. So very often you can correct modern notions by asking these questions in a historical perspective. And I think that this is extremely important because I see again and again, and since 2011, I have seen that, how practitioners' views spill over into martial arts studies. Because people who are doing martial arts studies, they have been trained probably in one martial art. They have been doing this for a couple of years, and they internalize the myths that these martial arts are telling about themselves. And then they bring it unquestioned into martial arts studies. And then they raise secondary questions that would not need to be raised if you ask the proper first question, I think.
So there's problems of epistemology and mythology kind of seeping into everything. I mean, you once sort of reprimanded me in a review that you wrote, saying like, whenever Bowman uses the term martial arts, he always implicitly means East Asian martial arts.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But I mean, I thought about that a lot, and I didn't fully interrogate that, but I have since, and I still think I would stand by it. I think with a lot of caveats and a lot of qualifications, I would still say the term martial arts is overdetermined and heavily implies East Asian martial arts, and that's despite HEMA, historical European martial arts, it's despite Brazilian jiu-jitsu and capoeira, and all of the all of the African martial arts and all of the indigenous martial arts that we all now know about, we know more and more about, like almost every culture surely has something that could fall into that category. But I think that the term martial arts emerged as a term really in the 1970s, in response to the kind of films that you and I loved when we were were children.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you, and I think that shows our different perspective, because your perspective then is the term martial arts is heavily overloaded, leaning towards the Asian martial arts side in general popular discourse. If you ask anyone on the street what is martial arts, yeah, it's like in, when they do in China, absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. And when I use it, when I want to use it in martial arts studies, as I see it, I want to use it as a descriptive, as an academic term.
Yeah.
That is aiming to include the worldwide phenomenon.
Yeah.
Once again, this is my background, is my training in history of religion, Burkhard Gladigo. Yeah? Somebody wrote about Gladigo and he meant it positively at one point. In Gladigo's perspective, the history of religion becomes a history of ideology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
So if I would have asked Professor Gladigo, well, could I write my master thesis about Stalinism as a religious system? He would, yeah, of course, just do it. Yeah. If you were to ask anyone on the street what is religion, they would say, yeah, it's Christendom and it's Islam and it's Buddhism. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So the academic term must not necessarily correlate to the use of the word in general discourse.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah. And so both is fine. Both is fine. As I say, this is a different perspective, I think, that you and I are having, and it's just important that we make clear what we are talking about.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, I implicitly agree with that displacement. So the conference that we were meant to be having in Marseille in July, which has been cancelled or postponed, or will change form into maybe an online format because of the pandemic. I think we were both preparing to give papers that really treated the question of martial arts and religion in terms of the question of ideology, or if not ideology, belief.
Yeah.
Like, and trust and faith. Yeah. You know, you when you walk into a club, or when you fantasize about a club, like when you're looking for the answer to something, and there's all those different dimensions, like you engage in a practice and you start to believe in it. Like,
yeah,
you believe that the movements you are doing will be effective, they are real, and they actually exist, and you believe in the historical founders and the myths and the legends. But you don't even need to believe in the myths and the legends to still believe in your practice. So, I mean, I argued in the organization of that conference that there should be a lot more emphasis on the word belief.
Yeah.
But my co-organizers, they were more interested in religions, kind of anthropological sense.
Yeah.
I mean, are we talking about belief here, like faith? Like faith in Stalin, faith in Wing Chun, faith in Shotokan, or
We are also talking about that, I guess. Yeah, this is something that we once addressed when we're talking about mythologies of martial arts. So, what narratives have to be developed to make people believe that what they are doing is actually true, meaning that it will develop the skill set that they want to have in the first place. So it is about belief, about trust in something, and about how to instill that trust in the practitioners.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, for me, when I talk about martial arts and religion, about how martial arts could work as, and all these terms are super complicated, substitute religions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The thing that I was laughing about when the call for papers came out for the Marseille conference, at first I was like, fantastic, I'm really looking forward to that. And it's a great pity that it cannot take place. But also I found it kind of funny because we have that super problematic term of martial arts on the one side. Yeah. And nobody can define what it is or wants to define what it is. And on the other hand, we have the super, super, super problematic term of religion. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's this famous thing, somebody in the history of religion counted once how many definitions, academic definitions, are out there that are widely cited for what a religion is. And he counted like 153 or something.
Yeah.
And not one of them is generally agreed upon. And now we bring these two super complicated concepts together to see how they interact. So this
and added to that was the term spirituality. So the title was Martial Arts, Religion, and Spirituality.
Yeah, fantastic.
I don't know what spirituality is. Like, you know, it seems to be a sort of massive area of gullibility in the place of formal religion. That seems to be what spirituality is, but I don't know. So it was going to be a very lively
absolutely. But I mean, this is the Luckmann Shrinking Transcendence, Expanding Religion is the important article or essay in the history of religion, where he states that we live in a change of religious life of people, and the transcendences are shrinking. Yeah? What he means is that the opposite, the religious opposite that you adhere to, like God, paradise, they become less and less. But therefore, religion can be everything, like personal development, embetterment, political concepts like democracy. He thinks that, or spirituality, that these ideologies fulfill roles that before were fulfilled by one common universal other, higher than human being. Yeah. And I think that you could apply that very well to martial arts studies when talking about or thinking about martial arts as, again, substitute, I don't like the term, but substitute religions, just to shorten.
Yeah, there was I remember a quote from the novelist Martin Amis, who said, the problem with the death of God is not that people believe in nothing, but that they'll now believe in anything.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Brilliant quote. Thank you. Yeah, it's more or less exactly what in that thinking transcend, but put a little bit nicer.
Yeah. So tell us now about your PhD and your studies in Scandinavian literature, Scandinavian studies. Tell us what you did there.
I'm specialized with this connection of Scandinavian studies, history of religion, and medieval history that I also studied. I was concentrating on the history of pre- and peri-Christian Germanic religion, Germanic heathendom, so to say. And after my master thesis, I got a huge crisis in academia, and I was like, all this humanities is bullshit, who needs that? And didn't want to do that anymore. So I studied sports for a while at the university, but I quit that again because I felt too old at that point. And I was away from university for a while, and then at some point when I was in Iceland, I thought, why don't I bring together the two things that really matter in my life, the two things I'm doing, which is my academic training and my martial arts background. And then I proposed to my professor Wirth from Tübingen, couldn't I do a PhD in Scandinavian studies on how combat and fighting is described in medieval Icelandic literature. And I'm very thankful for her too, because she said, yeah, that's cool. Mm-hmm. Let's do it. Yeah. And then I did it.
And what, so this was an understudied, this people hadn't been studying the description of combat in this literature, had people, but they didn't know enough about combat, or what was your unique line on this?
Yeah, for a weird reason, it was really understudied. So you find the odd comments on the combat scenes here and there in academic literature on Old Norse, but it was never or very seldomly, like, thoroughly, completely researched. And this is really weird because combat scenes play such a huge role in medieval Icelandic literature, especially in the saga of Icelanders. The things that people do read when they read Old Norse literature, modern translation. So these are basically like Wild West films. Yeah? The one guy steals the cattle of another guy, then they go over there and burn down his house, then they come and kill his brother, stuff like that. So there's fighting going on all the time. Yeah? And the fight scenes are extremely important because they are used by the authors to reflect on the characters and on the general dynamics of the story. So it was weird that it never had been studied, probably because it was too far away of everyday life of the academics, or because it's a touchy topic, because this is below us, all this violence. I don't know why, but it's really interesting once you start to look at it.
So what are the main the main types of combat we see? What are the main weapons? I mean, is there a dominant form of combat that the literature prefers, or do you see all different types of combative events?
you see all different types. You see all different types because Old Norse literature is extremely rich and is divided into several subgenres, and these subgenres can even shift within one story. And when they shift, they start to describe fights differently. Yeah? It is compared with modern cinema. When you watch Ong Bak or The Raid, a fight would look differently than when you have just a fist fight in a thriller or something. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So fighting can be aestheticized, it can be exaggerated, it can be very brief and violent. And Old Norse literature has the option to use all these different ways to describe fighting. So there is not one. Yeah. There are several. Yeah.
And what do we, can we make any connections with a reality outside the text? I mean, is there are there different genres and different ways of describing it, fighting, and different ways of staging fighting scenes in the various literatures? Then, I mean, are there any that you could say, actually, this we could call this realism? Yeah. Is there anything there that we could call realism?
Yeah, there are. That was my basic interest, my basic research question was that. We have the fight books from medieval Europe. Mm-hmm. Daniel Jacquet, my friend, was talking with you about these books too, which describe fighting techniques, but we do not have anything from Iceland. And I was wondering, can we deduce from the literature, if it is so rich in combat scenes, can we deduce whether these people had actual combat training, whether they had something like a fencing culture? So is there realism in the combat scenes? Yeah? And to be able to do this, first you have to understand the literary dimension mm-hmm. of the combat scenes. This is something that is often not done when hobbyists approach these sagas. Yeah? All of them are translated into English, yeah? So you can just read them and look them up, and then without any understanding of the historical context of the super complicated literary history, you would just go like, oh, so the Vikings fought like this because it's in here. This obviously doesn't work. Yeah? It is the same as if you would want to deduce the combat methods of Northern American native plain people of the 19th century from Wild West movies of the 20th century. Yeah. So you have to sieve out all the other information.
Yeah.
And then probably there's a core of realism. And yes, there is.
So, but there's also a core of political realism in the modern context, where you get people who are invested for various either fantasy or ideological reasons in reconstructing or attempting to reconstruct a version of their kind of Nordic past. And they read the English translation of, or watch the film, they watch Beowulf or something, and go, right, so I've got blonde hair, so I must be a Viking, right? And, and I'm going to buy a sword and a hammer. And so I mean, that it circulates in a complex discourse, doesn't it, where people believe, they project and invest in these texts in different ways, that some of which are really dubious.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a problem of martial arts in general, I think, that is often tied to ideas of nationality, of race, of identity. Our martial art, usually our martial art, whichever that is the best. And it has been practiced by us for 2000 years, and it has not been adulterated by combination with other martial arts, which is always crap. Yeah, but everybody tells that about their own martial arts. And if you don't have your own martial art, then you need to find it in some historic documents.
Yeah.
And then you need to reconstruct it. I mean, there's this movie, Reclaiming the Blade, about the HEMA scene, is a couple of years old. And there you have, I don't know who that was, but you have a Swedish HEMA is saying, yeah, I'm not so much interested in studying Japanese sword because I want to train what my forefathers did. Well, you're a Swedish guy of the 20th century, but you're training German and Italian sword fighting methods of the 14th, 15th century. So this is not exactly your forefathers. Why are these people closer to you than modern day Japanese?
Yeah,
I don't get it. But obviously, this is about identity construction.
Yeah, and what do you? I mean, what do you, as a museum curator and someone a curator of exhibitions and so on? I mean, what's your take on the relationship between the historic artifacts and contemporary cultural identity? What's the, what's the good way of doing this, and what's the bad way of doing this?
I try to show people the width of, for example, a phenomenon like martial arts. Yeah. That probably this is also why I'm so against this connection between martial arts and Asia. Martial arts are only Asian. I would have the same problem if somebody said martial arts are only African or they are only European or anything. It's a general phenomenon. And I think it always helps to show people that mankind on various places at various times wasn't stupid. So these people had good ideas, and they developed methods to deal with their everyday life. And usually these methods are quite good. We have this question, for example, about swords all the time. So the best sword for a long, long time, of course, was the Japanese sword. Yeah, and that's what everybody believed. And then the pendulum shifted. And nowadays, maybe many people would say, yeah, but the European swords, the European long sword is actually much better than the katana. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the whole question, what is the best? I think this is the problem, because you have fantastic swordsmiths from Portugal to Tokyo, and from Finland down to South Africa. So there's blades everywhere, and these people were good in producing them. And as a museum curator, I try to show people that humans at various places were extremely skillful.
Yeah. I was going to say something then, but I've lost it, because that question was so interesting. There's something else that I always remember. There's several things that you have said to me that just always pop into my head, like just almost every day sometimes.
Maybe
like,
it was hit harder.
Yeah, be lava. But the first thing that you said that stuck in my head was that the first time I met you, and you said, why did you have this conference? Because it used to be the case that an academic interest in martial arts was career suicide. So I always think of the term as career suicide. That. And then the other thing is a comment that you wrote on Facebook one time. Someone had posted something about like devising a new way to study martial arts, and you just wrote, congratulations on managing to ignore everything we've written about this for the last 5
years. Yes.
Quite an achievement.
Yes, it's frustrating. I mean, we all have a lot to do, and you do not have as much time as you would want to have to read just everything that comes out. Nobody can do this. But we have been active now in the field for almost a decade. And before us, other people have been doing that stuff since the end of the 19th century. So there's a lot of good literature out there. And how can you ignore all that?
Yeah.
Like, we have to be.
Yeah. You used to say, why do we have to go back to zero every time?
Yes. Yes.
So that's one of the reasons why I thought it was really important to start the journal Martial Arts Studies.
Yes.
And to try and stimulate book publication that's accessible, and because people are just, but this happened, this is not just like non-academics. It's not just the case like, oh, aren't non-academics like lazy because they don't buy books or anything. But actually, you know, I, as a professor, I get sent a lot of journal articles to review. And 9 times out of 10, I'm saying, why didn't they just carry out a literature review to see what people had thought and argued and said and shown about it? And academics don't do it. They just go, oh, they wake up one day and go, I think I'll write about karate or judo or tai chi. Like, it's a new idea.
Yeah.
It happened. It's bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a pity. And I mean, usually when you start, when you teach a university course, this is one of the first things that you would teach beginners. Just look it up. This is part of your job. I don't know why it's not done.
It's so odd. I understand. There's some things that I do understand. Like, for instance, a professor once came to Cardiff to give a talk about the Ip Man films. You know, it was this at the time when there was only about 5 Ip Man films, and now there's about 25 or something. But And he gave his talk, And I said, but have you read, and have you read, and I wrote, and did you? And he said, no, what I wanted to do was just watch the films and think about what I thought first. But I know I will have to go and, but he didn't want to like mess up his thinking by having it cluttered up with other people's arguments first. And I understand that. I understand that, because sometimes taking that time to actually do the, to read other people's articles, it can snuff out the flame of your interest before. But there's no excuse for committing to paper before doing
it. But then, I mean, simple, you can do that, but then it's too early to put it out. Then why are you having the presentation already? Then
you write. To his credit, he said, please, like I said, can I record this? He said, no, because this is literally me thinking and wanting to bounce. He wanted it to be more like a seminar, but you would never do that. Six Wetzler would never do this.
I almost did in Trier.
In Trier, that was
Trier was a great Trier was a different thing when I talked about the sword and what the sword could mean. And but I said it at the very beginning, like this is not what I would usually do.
The other thing that I always remember when I think about you is after a conference in Cardiff and we'd been out and all the bars had shut, there was literally nowhere else to go, and we went back to the student accommodation where we were staying. And I'd had a few, maybe a couple of beers, maybe one or two. And we were sitting around a table and I was going out having a really serious conversation with you and saying how I really liked unarmed combat, but I wasn't really, I didn't like knives and I didn't. And you start quoting from Conan the Barbarian, he's like, son, you must learn the riddle of steel. You must solve the riddle of steel. And then you went on several years later to give the paper at a conference in Trier called, like, was it Revisiting the Riddle of Steel?
Or Reconsidering the Riddle of Steel.
So tell us the Riddle of Steel and tell us the solution to the Riddle of Steel.
I'm still working on the solution to the Riddle of Steel. The Riddle of Steel, okay, of course, in the movie means something completely different. But for me, the Riddle of Steel, what I mean with it is, why are people fascinated with swords? With blades in general, but what makes the fascination of a sword as an object? This is in my job, this is the riddle of steel. Because I see that in the reaction of the visitors that come to the museum. Now, not everyone, but many people have that fascination, sometimes also horror, for the sword, but it is, of course, obviously something that resonates within people. And there has been such a dominant symbol in human culture. Like every culture that was able to produce swords used it as a core symbol in their alphabet of symbolic meanings. And it is the sword. Usually it's the sword. It's not the battle axe, it's not the spear, even though the spear is probably more important in military history than the sword, but it is the sword that draws this attention, and this is what I've been wondering. This is for me the riddle of steel, and what I'm trying to solve.
I mean, with that, we've got there were people at the conference in Trier who did challenge you on your claim that it is such an almost kind of quasi-universal symbol. Or of something, of some kind of potency and power and terror as well. Shock and awe and terror. And people queried that, but basing it on the anthropological possibility of cultures without metal. But you answered, how did you answer that again?
They were right. Like I don't mean it as a universal symbol. I'm not a Jung. I don't know how to say that. Jungian scholar. So I do not believe that this is an archetype that is embedded somewhere deep down in our collective consciousness. Blah blah blah. I think that in a culture where you have the sword, it attracts all these symbolic meanings. And this is something that you can see in like any culture. Of course, if you have a culture that does not have swords, maybe they will use another symbol. Maybe they will use their war club or the paddle or an axe or something. That might be. I'm not too well studied in these kind of cultures. I'm dealing with obviously mostly metal blades, metal producing cultures. But what I meant is, wherever you find the sword, it attracts these meanings.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I've been on my, oh, what's this? Oh, I've got that's alert for my next meeting, which I will be late for, I think. But I'm having too much fun. Yeah, in my undergraduate teaching this semester, there was we were looking at a lot of psychoanalytic theories around the body. And a really big one was Julia Kristeva's notion of abjection. Now, you may not have touched that, but because when we were in Trier, I was talking about a book called The Psychoanalysis of Fire by... by Blanchot or someone, I can't remember who it was by. But Julia Kristeva's notion of abjection, and it's the abjection, it relates to that which divides the inside from the outside, or shows us the ultimate kind of abject object is the corpse. It kind of fascinates and revulses us. And I guess the sword isn't the ultimate object of going inside where it shouldn't be, and also bringing that inside outside in ways that we want that boundary policed, you know. We don't want our innards oozing out. We don't want metal in our body.
This is one, I think, of the reasons why it is such a fascinating object, because it's almost metaphysical. You're talking about boundaries. So how small is the boundary? Here's my skin, the inside, the outside. It's a very thin layer, and the sword in itself, with the edge is like this as well. It gets smaller and smaller and smaller. By getting smaller and smaller, it has the power to shape and create reality and to separate things that were one before. You cut them. Now suddenly they are two. It's like magic. You create reality, and it's able to pierce. To disrupt this boundary of inside and outside. By piercing something, and this is also like a metaphysical thing maybe about martial arts, it condenses time and space. Because it's only about that one point in time and one point in space. So will the weapon pierce your skin or not? Everything is whole reality is condensed into that one thing. And I think this is also one that we in some way intuitively understand. And also, I was very thankful for your hint on that text on fire, psychology of fire, because this is a very practical, not so metaphysical, but very practical reason when people cut themselves for the first time as a kid, they learn to fear the blade, they learn to understand the blade, and they intentionalize this fear, like the fear of fire or of a hot oven. This is something that stays with them. Once you've been cut for the first time, people are afraid of the knife, of the sword, when you're threatened. And they are afraid differently than they would be from a club or another weapon.
Yeah, I guess this probably relates to, because I think that night sitting around the table when you proposed to me that I really did need to solve the riddle of steel, I think one of the points I may have been making was, I really love wooden weapons because I think until you really get them moving, they're safe. Like, then they feel lovely. The texture of I have lots of wooden weapons and I train with them and they feel like they're good for my limbs and they're good for my joint mobility and my strength. You can get a nice safe-ish workout with them. And it's really only when you get them in motion. And when they're in motion, they're beautiful, but they're still not necessarily deadly in the way that being gently grazed by a sharp knife is deadly. I mean, I know that you like wooden weapons too. I mean, you say that you've been doing a lot of quarterstaff training at the moment, which I really approve of because it's a wonderful weapon. I mean, what's your relationship with the two sorts of weapons? Do you make a distinction when you're training?
The distinction is mainly obviously you do it for safety reasons also when you train with a partner, but again it's a psychological difference, and that is huge. And this is something that I'm also interested in as a museum guy, and that we should also look at in martial arts studies. This is from our perspective, I think, an under-researched field. The object, what does the object do with the body and the mind of the practitioner? somewhat quoting Ben Spatz, what a body can do. My talk in Trier was called "What Can a Sword Do?" or something like this. Yeah. So the wooden weapon, if you start to teach people in Filipino martial arts, for example, and you give them a wooden knife and you give them a drill with a knife, and then they move, and at some point they do it fast, but for them it's still a game, more or less. And then you give them, when they are skillful with a drill, you give them a sharp knife, you do the same, and suddenly, they do it slow. They are afraid of the metal themselves. So the reaction of us to the steel is obviously different. You know? Yeah. This is a matter of being used to something, of course, too. Yeah, if you do it then with a sharp knife, with a knife blade all the time, maybe you get used to it until you cut yourself.
Yes.
And then you're getting careful again.
Yeah.
And if we look at historical sources, there's different approaches to that. Also in the history of European martial arts, there are some Italian masters who would say, no, you should always train with the sharp, because otherwise it's just playing and you will never learn. And others say, no, you should train, of course, with dull training weapons, because you would kill yourself.
Yeah. And I guess because you're someone who will have a go at anything. You're quite playful in a lot of your approaches to the physical stuff and interacting with a partner and so on. I guess you're of the school where you train with everything, and you train in every way: hard, soft, slow, fast, intensity, lightheartedly, because I guess you just want to kind of live it and it to become natural in every circumstance. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't go to unfortunately, I don't go to dance classes regularly. I'm not dancing tango or anything. I'm not doing other kinds of sports. So this is my physical output. Yeah. And this is something that is beautiful about martial arts, I think. That can be anything. It can be your personal workout. It can be hard, tough sparring, but it can also be kind of dancing and thus communicating with other people. I think that is important for me. It is important to train like this because it keeps your motivation, various ways. It reflects the martial arts on my life. Probably today I should do a hard training, but I don't feel like it. Maybe it's a good day not to do a hard training. And I also think that to become really proficient in the long term as a martial artist, you should have these different levels. Mm-hmm. This is my approach. Yeah. That was fascinating for me when I was doing ancient karate, and we prepared for the competitions. We were always doing like hardcore sparring. Yeah. Sparring was so painful. And then I saw a training video of Andy Hook, the great Andy Hook, the K1 champion. Mm-hmm. And when they were doing sparring, it looked like play fighting.
Yeah,
they were super soft, and I was impressed. And I was like, he's one of the top fighters on the world. Maybe it's a good way to train like this as well. Mm-hmm. And in Pekka Tertia, we have all these different levels. And I always have the quote from Leo Gahe in my head, like, play with it.
Yeah.
Gives you some methods, and now play with it.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Sixt Wetzler, I think we both need to get back to work today.
Unfortunately.
It would be great to talk to you for ages. I'll talk to you again sometime soon. But for now, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Paul. That was fun.